This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Paul, well, thank you. And this morning we want to talk about mission, vision, and values. And if you're having a hard time communicating with your staff or employees, you're not alone. Bill Clinton once said in a speech in California, or in Illinois, that running a country is kind of like running a cemetery. You have a lot of people under you, but nobody's listening. Sometimes it feels a little that way, doesn't it? But mission, vision, and values help us to keep everything on track and to know what we're trying to accomplish, where we're headed. And we're going to talk a little bit about definitions of those things, but also we want to talk some about how do you keep them just from being a plaque on the wall or a paper in a drawer somewhere. Like, I talk to people in organizations, say, like, do you have a mission statement? Yeah, it's somewhere. We got one, but nobody knows what it is. And a mission statement, a vision statement, your core values, they should actually be, like, people should know what they are. They should be giving some guidance to what you're doing and how you're doing what you're doing. So we want to talk about that this morning. We're going to start with mission. Mission is the reason for your existence. Why does your organization exist? What's the reason you actually exist? Now, a mission statement is not a description of the service you provide. It's not like we're a school, or we provide education, but it's the reason for your existence. It also should be something you'll never get finished doing. It's always pursued, but never completely fulfilled. So your mission statement should be something that you can do in 100 years from now. You could still be working at doing that. So if your mission is to share the gospel with the lost, you're going to be able to do that a long time. You're never going to get done doing that. If your mission is to educate children, there's going to be children 100 years from now. So you're going to be able to, you're not going to get done doing it. Your mission statement should be written in a way that you can keep pursuing that for a long time. Here's some examples. Merit Corporation, their mission statement was to preserve and improve human life. 3M was to solve unsolved problems innovatively. Walt Disney was to make people happy. So you can work at making people happy for a long time. That's something that you'll never get done doing. So these are examples of mission statements that give you, this is our focus, this is why we exist, this is what we're trying why we're here. Here's our open hands mission statement, to provide Christ-centered economic opportunities for the poor. So we'll never get done doing that. There's always going to be more poor people that we can provide economic opportunities for, and so we can keep working on that. Here's an example from the life of Jesus. In Luke chapter 4, verse 18 and 19, Jesus gets up in the synagogue and he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And then in chapter 19 of Luke, he says, "The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." There you go. That's something he's still doing, right? And those things are still happening. So it never gets finished. So your mission statement, your reason for existence, something you'll never get done doing. Then we go to values, or core kingdom values. This is a small set of guiding principles. This is more things that are so important to you that they very rarely change. They can change, but these are the things that guide how you do what you do. And they make a difference in how you do what you're doing. They're largely independent of the current environment, the competition, and the facts. So they're not things that, well, everybody's doing it that way, so we'll do it that way. No, these are things that give you guidance. And even if it means that you are going to lose some of your programs, are you're not going to be able to do some things. You are so committed to these that you're going to do it no matter what. So think about it. If you're in an organization and you're getting funding from donors or from a government agency, and they say, well, we want you to do what you're doing in a certain way, and it doesn't fit your core values, you're going to say, no, thank you. We won't accept that gift, or we won't take that funding, because we're not going to do it that way. That goes against our values, and if we can't follow our values, well, we won't take the money, or we won't do the program. And it may mean, if, say, for example, you're doing something in a school, and the school says, well, you can't share the gospel in the school. You can't talk about the Lord Jesus in school. Okay, well, then we won't do anything in the school, because that's just part of who we are. It's how we do things, and it's something that's so important to us that we would actually give up opportunities because we're not going to change our values. They don't require any external justification. You don't have to justify your core values. You don't have to... Now, they may be based on Scripture, but they may just be things that you say, these are things that we are committed to, and this is how we do things. You may have a value of, we never go into debt, and we're just not going to borrow money. And so you may have opportunities that if you borrowed money, you could do it, but no, one of your values is we don't borrow money. It doesn't have to be justified by anything. You don't have to find a verse that says don't borrow money. You don't have to, like... They don't have to be based on... It can just be, this is how we want to do it. And these things are so important to us that we're gonna do these things. They're about you and your values. They're so fundamental and deeply held that they seldom, if ever, change. Like I said, they can change, but they probably won't change very often. And you probably want to really think through, if you're going to change your core values, why are you changing them? And what's bringing about that change? And like we said, if the circumstances change, you'd be penalized for having this value. You'd still keep it. You would do it no matter if it cost you something. I remember that my father was in the trucking business at one point. And we had an opportunity for a contract to haul brick for Glengarry Corporation, and it would have been a big deal. Like it would have been really huge. Like the company would have probably doubled or tripled in size.
Okay, thank you.
So we were in the negotiations, and everything looked good. The rates were good. We had finalized all the details of the contract, and right at the very end, one of the executives from Glengarry said, "Oh, just one more thing. All of your drivers have to be union members to come into the plant." And we're like, that's a deal breaker for us. And they were like, what? Like, what, I mean, just get them union cards. It's not that hard, right? We said, no, we don't do that. That's not, it goes against our beliefs as to how problems should be resolved. And we just, we're peacemakers. We're not confrontational. And we just don't do that. And we never completed the contract. And the company stayed the same size. So they are, that's the kind of thing. Your values set your, determine what you can do and what you can't do sometimes. Your values become external promises and internal motivation. So to your customers, your clients, your participants in your ministry, they are promises. This is, we will do this. You can expect this from us. We're honest. We're respectful. You can expect us to treat you with respect. You can expect us to be honest with you. So they become promises externally. Internally, they become motivation. So your staff, your people in the organization, this is what we expect you to do. And this is how we measure whether we're successful or not. You may be able to run a program, but if you do it and you're not honest, if you do it and you're not respectful, then you're not successful. So we have to, it becomes part of how we do what we do, and our staff get motivated by it. And it's really good if you can find some way of measuring these things. Like, how are we doing? Evaluation. How are we doing? Because you know what? People will produce what you measure. If you look at
what you're doing or what you want to happen and you're frustrated because it's not happening, one of the ways to make it start to happen is start measuring it and start finding a way of measuring your commitment to people and how you're doing, because when you're measuring something, it tends to be produced. Kingdom values are often one-word statements, so they're not long sentences. They're just statements. Here's some from corporations: Merit Corporation, corporate social responsibility, Sony being a pioneer, not following others, doing the impossible. Here's the core values from Anabaptist Financial: brotherhood, integrity, responsiveness, stewardship. So one word things. So hopefully when you deal with Anabaptist Financial, this is what you experience. And it's a commitment to brotherhood, to integrity, to responsiveness. So if you've called Anabaptist Financial and they haven't called you back, call them up and tell them, hey, you guys aren't following your core values. You need to get with the program. But there again, I know that from my past involvement in Anabaptist Financial, one of the things they were doing was they were measuring the time between when a person requested a loan and when they got an answer, because that's part of responsiveness. So if that's taking too long and people are saying, you know, we're not hearing from you, and well, start measuring it. Start keeping track of how long was it from the time we got the first call from the person who wanted to borrow money until we actually gave them an answer, whether they got the loan or not. And you start measuring that, and it's amazing how it comes down, because everybody in the office knows this is going on a paper somewhere and somebody up the line is seeing it, and we don't want it to be too long. So that's how it guides what happens within the organization. Here's some from Jesus. Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 to 40. Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. The second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So loving God, loving your neighbor. Just values that are crucial. And then Matthew 9, compassion. Those are some of the things that were characteristic of how Jesus did his ministry. Isn't it amazing? You read the Synoptic Gospels and you read about Jesus' ministry, how relaxed he was in doing what he was doing. You never read any passages in the Gospels where Jesus is saying to the disciples, hey guys, can you pick up the pace a little bit? Like, you know, we got people over here waiting for us, and you know, we got to get over here, and come on guys, like, can we jog this last section? And even times when he was really busy, and then he'd be able to focus on one person and give them his full attention. And then in John, at the end, he kind of says, Father, I've done everything you gave me to do. There were still lots of blind people. There were still lots of lame people. There were still lots of people who had rejected his message. But somehow he had the confidence, I've done what you gave me to do. And he had that guided sense. And he demonstrated these things throughout his ministry. All right, let's go to vision then. Vision is a clear, vivid description of a desired outcome. So now you're talking about what's going to happen. If we work at our mission statement, we follow our core values, what's the result going to be? What's it going to look like? And you start to envision the world as it will be, or your clientele as they will be, or the people you're serving as they will be, if you're successful in doing what you're doing. A vision statement will come from a particular vantage point. So you're looking at your ministry, and you're looking at it from your vantage point. You're looking at, you know, when I look at the people we serve, this is what I'm going to see. This is what it's going to look like from my perspective. A vision statement paints a clear picture of what the organization wants to be or accomplish in a long period of time. Now, we can go two ways on vision statements. They can be so much pie in the sky that you'll never get there. That's your mission statement should be more that kind of statement. Or they can be so small that you're sure you're going to make it. And it's really doable. And you know, it won't take you very long. It should be somewhere in between. It should be realistic. It should be measurable. But it should be something, it's going to take you some time to do it. But it is possible. You can get there. And it is, you are able to reach it. But they need to be big and stretching and realistically achievable. mission statements are about the future and how your organization and its people will influence the future. Your reason for existence, your mission statement, probably has something to do with changing things in the world and making the world a different place, or having people in the world have a different experience of life. There's something that you're going to change in the world by pursuing your mission statement, and your vision statement describes what it's going to look like when that's accomplished. Vision is expressed in simple, clear statements. When you understand them, they almost take your breath away. That would be amazing. You know, we pray in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." You ever think about what it would be like if God had a switch and tomorrow morning he flipped that switch and his will would be done on earth as it is in heaven? It'd be kind of a it would really be a different place, wouldn't it? It'd be quite different from what we woke up to this morning. But that's what we're working at. That's what we're building the kingdom. We're doing the things that God wants done in the world. Maybe you saw the video clip a few years ago. I saw it of a man that was on an airplane. The lady next to him, they're talking about things, and the lady says to him, "So what do you do? Who do you work for?" And he said, "Well, I work for this organization. We do schools, we do hospitals, we run refugee camps, we do education, we distribute aid, we take care of AIDS victims, we have orphanages, and we're in every country, we're in almost every country of the world." And finally she says, "Wow, like, what's it called?" He said, "It's called the church." and that's what we're part of, because we're part of the change that God wants to see in the world. And if we really understood what God wanted to do with the world, it'd be like, wow, that would be amazing. And we get to be part of what God is doing in the world. Here's some examples from corporations. In 1990, Walmart wanted to be a $125 billion company by 2000. Sony in the 50s wanted to become the company most known for changing the worldwide poor quality image of Japanese products. Now, if you're in my age group, you understand that. When I was a boy, it was, well, there's the junk from Japan. And, you know, they really did change that, didn't they? Like, today, that's not the perception you have of Japanese products at all. It's precision, it's quality, and Sony wanted to be the leader in doing that. Boeing, 1950, wanted to become the dominant player in the commercial aircraft and bring the world into the jet age. So there were some big picture visions of what they wanted to be involved in as corporations. Here's our vision statement from Open Hands. "As Anabaptist followers of Christ, we desire to keep the commands of Scripture, to bear one another's burdens, and to consider the cause of the poor through the development of self-supporting micro-lending and micro-enterprise programs that teach biblical financial concepts and present the gospel of Jesus Christ for a witness to the nation." So we're looking at giving people opportunities economically, but also that bring them to the gospel and that bring them to the Lord Jesus Christ. And so biblical teaching is an important part of what we do in our group. So the groups are important, what they save is important, but the gospel being shared in those groups is as important as what happens economically. Here's something from the life of Jesus. He says, "I'm the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal and to kill and to destroy. I am come that they might have life and have it more abundantly." What an inspiring statement that is. Like, his purpose was for us to really have a fulfilling, abundant life. And that's what he does for us. That's how he's... Let's talk about the leader and the vision. Because you as a leader, if you are a leader in your organization, you have an important part to play in the vision. You direct the process of determining the vision. I believe that a vision statement is not something that you kind of go in a corner and you write and then announce it to your staff and say, "Here, this is our vision statement." No, it's a corporate project. You work on it together. You get ideas. You toss things around. You revise it and you revise it some more. But you are the leader in that process. You are the one who is directing that process. But one of the ways you get people to buy into the vision statement is that they get involved in writing it. They get involved in deciding what the vision statement is. Then you get more buy-in from people because they had involvement in writing the vision statement. Then you become the promoter of the vision. You're the person who's reminding people, this is what we're doing. This is why we're here. This is what we're going to accomplish. You keep the vision clear and central to the activities of the organization. So you make the connection between what you're doing, the activities of the organization, your vision statement. You keep reminding people, we're doing this because we want to see people come to Christ. We're doing this because we want to preach the gospel. We're doing this because we want to educate children. This is how it fits in. You keep reminding people what they're doing on a daily basis, how it ties into the vision statement, how it's tied into the mission statement, and so that people aren't just doing busy work. They're not just killing time. They're actually working toward the goals that the organization has. And you keep the vision alive. You're the one who's promoting it. You're the one who keeps talking about it. If it winds up in a drawer somewhere, or it winds up just being a plaque on the wall, that's probably your fault if you're the leader, because you are the one who has to keep it relevant in front of people, reminding people what it is, and keeping it alive in your people's minds. So how do you communicate the vision? Well, to your core leadership team, you explain the importance of the vision. And especially if you're in an organization where there's changeover in staff, as people come into the organization, that you orient them in what the vision is, what the mission statement is, and then you create team buy-in to the vision and keep it current so that your team is behind the vision. Then the leadership team models and follows the vision. If your leadership team doesn't live by your core values, if your leadership, you see, every organization has kind of a corporate culture or atmosphere. Your leadership team creates that atmosphere, that culture. Now, some things like planning and your vision statement, it can bubble up from the bottom. But your organizational culture and atmosphere is going to be influenced much more from the top down, because people are watching you. How do you do? What do you do? What's your response when something goes wrong? How do you respond when there's a failure? And then that's going to filter down through the organization. I saw an interview with what was his name? He was the CEO of Ford Motor Company 10 years ago, but he came from Boeing and came to Ford. And when he got to Ford, the people in Ford Motor Company, the executives and stuff, said, "You don't know anything about cars." And he said, "No, I don't know anything about cars, but you know what? I know about building airplanes. And cars can break down, and it's not a tragedy, but if one airplane breaks down, everybody hears about it. So I think I can oversee building cars." So Ford Motor Company was in a time when they were losing money and sales were going down. It was not good. And so he came to the first meeting where all the department managers came together, and he set up a system of where they looked at each project and they rated it red light, yellow light, or green light. Red light was, it's a disaster. It's likely to fail. We're really in trouble here. Yellow was, we're not sure, but it really needs help. And green was, everything's good. So he came to the first meeting. Everybody's reporting on the things that are happening in the country. Everything was green light. And he just looked at them and said, "Guys, like, we're losing money. Sales are going down. You all have green lights. Like, we'll never fix anything in this company if you guys don't have any problems. Like, somebody's got to have some problems here somewhere." So the next meeting, they came. Everything's green. But one of the guys had a yellow light. And they said, when this guy said this one project was yellow light, they said it got deathly silent in the boardroom. And this guy who is the CEO, he stood up and started applauding. And he said, "Now we can start fixing the company because somebody has a problem." And they said the next meeting, there were red and yellow lights all over the place. Because you see, that's corporate culture. That's corporate atmosphere. And so what you open it up to, like, it's okay to have problems. Like, then that starts to filter down through it. And then you can, so you are responsible a lot if you're in leadership for the corporate culture and atmosphere. Rollo May said, "Communication leads to community, that is to understanding, intimacy, and mutual value." Your leadership team creates the core of your corporate culture, which is just what I was saying. If your leadership doesn't understand and follow the vision, it's unlikely that anybody else will do so. So your leadership team is important in setting your, following your vision and actually having it be something that's meaningful. So how do you, to communicate it to your leadership team and really get them to live it out is crucial to it filtering down through the rest of the organization. Then communicating vision to your staff or employees, staff meetings. There's nothing more demoralizing than a leader who can't clearly articulate why we're doing what we're doing. If the leader doesn't know where we're headed, it's pretty discouraging. And so at your staff meeting, it's a time to get your vision out, review it, go over it, and don't be afraid of bringing it out, saying what you're doing. Company or organizational events. If you have a company picnic or you have an organizational Christmas banquet or something, review your mission statement. Review your vision statement. Go over your core values. Like, people should, when you start your spiel about vision or core values, people should know what you're going to say. I mean, they should sit there and go, oh, here we go again. But that's great because they know it and they know what you're going to say and they're familiar with it and they know what you're expecting. Bulletin board notices. And I'm a great fan of catching people doing good. There's this whole concept of one-minute management and just, like, management by walking around. And don't get stuck in an office somewhere. Like walk around. Find your people doing good. Compliment them. What happens to you when your boss compliments you? It's like, he notices, right? When you're in an organization, look for people who are doing the right things. Compliment them. Point them out. Don't always be looking for things people are doing wrong. Catch people doing the right things, and people will produce. It's like in my marriage, when my wife smiles, I'm happy, right? Because my job is to make her happy. So... Now, sometimes I know what I need to do that. Sometimes, because I'm a man, I have to ask, what do you want me to do? And then I can do it. But, you know, if my wife tells me some things that I can do that make her happy, I'll do them over and over again. Like, we as men are pretty simple creatures. If you feed us and give us a couple compliments, we'll do amazing things for you. And that's true for your staff. You provide for them. You give them some compliments. They'll produce amazing things for you if you notice what's happening. Okay, then to your clients and your constituency, organizational promotional materials should have your vision statement, mission statement, your core values, newsletters, another place to have them, posters in reception areas, promotional brochures. Get your mission statement, your vision statement, your core values into your literature, into your promotional material, so people know what to expect and what kind of an organization you really are. Pursuing and maintaining vision. There's four characteristics in an organizational lifestyle. You have vision, or four component characteristics, I guess. Yeah, your vision, inclusion, programs, and management. Most organizations start with a vision. Somebody has a vision. This ought to be done. And people rally around a vision. And then there's inclusion because people want to be involved. And yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'll get involved in that. And then you develop programs. And then those programs have to be managed. So there's kind of a sequence there of these four components. But vision is the starting point. Vision is where it all starts. This is what we want to do. And this is going to be really good, and you want to be part of this. We talk about stages. At the birth, you have a capital V, you have lots of vision. There's very little inclusion. There may not even be any programs yet, and very little management. So you have lots of vision, a little inclusion, maybe some programs, maybe management. But the main thing is vision, and it's the organization starts based on the vision. Then in infancy, you have vision and you start to have inclusion. people buy in. Yeah, I want to help with that. I want to be part of that. That sounds like a really great idea, and I'll join you in that. I'll be part of that. And so you start to have, and that includes not only people who are on staff, it includes donors, it includes clients or your people you're serving, and people you start to have inclusion. People are attracted to the vision, or there's something that draws them to the vision. Then in adolescence, the programs start to grow. So now you have vision, you have inclusion, you have programs, things are happening. But it's still driven by the vision. The vision is a tether around which those things happen. Then in adulthood, everything is big letters, because you got the vision going, you have inclusion, you have donors, you have staff, you have clientele, you have programs that are working, and then those programs need management. So you have management for the programs. You know, many organizations, when they start, they don't have a policy manual. They're just, man, we're going to go do this. Then things start to happen, and we better make a policy about that. And, you know, sometimes I've read organizations' handbooks or policy manuals, and I read some things and I wonder, what did somebody do one day that made them write that policy? Because when you read an organization's policy manual, there's a reason that every policy in there exists. Somebody did something one day that somebody in the organization said, we need to make a policy about that. And so they did. So now at this point, you have that policy manual and you're managing the program. Now, as organizations go on, there can be a tendency for the vision to start to die. And now the programs are going, and, well, we're just doing. And then you start to have people like my age that are just, well, we always did it this way. And so we just keep doing it. And we just keep doing what we always did. We just get into an annual cycle or a monthly cycle. We just go around and around. We do the same stuff over and over again. We know how to do it. And we have, you know, so many retreats every year. We have, you know, so many classes, or we have so many seminars or whatever. We do this every year, and you just kind of go through the cycle, and the programs, they can almost run themselves, right? Because it's just, you're just repeating a cycle. Everybody knows what to do. And the vision can start, you can start to lose, why are we doing this? What are we trying to make happen? Because you see, the success is not simply in running a well-run program. You can run a well-run program and never accomplish anything. You can have a youth retreat and not get anything accomplished except eat pizza and play games. But if your vision is to have youth retreats to draw youth to Christ, you can have youth retreats and have a lot of fun and never draw kids to Christ. And so looking at, why are we doing this? What's the vision? And if it gets down to where it's just programs and we're just running through programs without the vision, then you're not accomplishing your vision. And organizations that get to maturity can, somebody has to keep the vision alive. Somebody has to do some creative thinking. Are we still doing the right things? And not every program has to last for eternity. Like, some programs need to die sometimes, because they've served their purpose, and the world changes, and the needs of the people you're serving change, and some programs really need to stop, and there's new things that need to start. And if you get stuck into a rut where you're just doing the same thing over and over, no matter what, it can be hard to keep the vision alive. And if the vision starts to die and you're just doing programs and management, eventually you get to the retirement stage where the inclusion starts to drop off, because people don't sign up to do programs. People sign up to change people. And so now it's going to be harder to find staff. It's going to be harder to find board members. It's going to be harder to find donors, because people are like, well, I don't know. I'm not sure what that program's about. And yeah, I know what they do, but I'm not sure why. And so it starts to fade. You keep going, you get to old age, where even your programs start to drop off because you don't have the finances, you don't have the people to do it, and it's all about management, and you're following your policies and doing what you can, and eventually the organization dies, and there's a little bit of management to wrap things up. And as you watch an organization, if an organization at this point doesn't revitalize their vision, they're just going to follow this this path to the point where they're going to go out of Asia. So if you're a leader in an organization, it's important that that you keep that vision alive. And organizations go through cycles, especially if you have a visionary founder who founded the organization, and it was all about vision, and it was all about a person's vision, and then that person retires or dies, and then it's like, so what's the organization about now? And unless a new leader comes along that has a vision and regenerates that vision, keeps that vision alive, or revitalizes the vision, you're just going to head down this path. And when, if your organization starts to become more about your past than about your future, you're in trouble. So you get down in here, that's when people start writing books about the history of the organization and you know, the last 50 years or 70 years and how the thing was started and all this. And there's nothing wrong with writing your history. Like, history is important. But I'm just saying, if the focus of your organization, when you're talking to your donors, you're talking to people about your organization, and it's more about how we started 40 years ago or our past as an organization, things we did 25 years ago, you're in trouble. Like, it has to be about the future. It has to be the balance there. You can talk about your past, but you really have to have a greater emphasis on the future, where we're headed. And the past gives you the platform for the future. But if the past becomes your reputation, you're going to die. So keep the vision alive. Keep your mission statement in focus. Have your core values. And then you have an organization that will be able to function and accomplish things. Do you have questions, anything you'd like to ask?
I just really appreciate you bringing in the testimony or the vision of Jesus. Just that solid foundation there, and including that in your lesson.
He knew why he was here and what he was doing, and he never lost that focus on that vision. Nathan?
You're looking at this from an organizational standpoint.
Yeah.
If you would apply this to a church structure, would you see a lot of changes, or would it pretty much apply the same?
Oh, boy. Now I need another... you're going to get me on one of my rants here. It's probably a little different for the church, but the same principles apply. Like, you have to know why does this church exist, and what are we trying to accomplish, and what are our commitments? What are we committed to? So, I think the core principles are the same. Now, my rant is that I think in the Conservative Mennonite Church, most of our churches came out of either a more conservative group or a more liberal group. And so in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and for a lot of us, our church's mission statement is, we're not them. And you know, in the 1970s, when I'm a member of a Mid-Atlantic church, and in the 1970s, when the Mid-Atlantic churches started, they came out of Leicester Conference. And, well, some people came out of the Eastern Church, so you had people going two different directions, but they were at the same place at that moment. And so that caused some issues. But there were people who... And so there were families that some people stepped out of Leicester Conference. They joined a Mid-Atlantic Church. So they get to family get-togethers, and their family members who were in Leicester Conference said, you guys are just kidding yourselves. You know, give yourself another generation, you'll be where we are anyway. So it's a lost cause. You can't stop what's happening. And those people made a vow, we will never be like them. And that's why nothing can change, right? Because if anybody suggests any changes, well, now we're on that slippery slope and we're going to wind up. But you now we're two generations later, or at least one. And if your grandfather left Leicester Conference in 1975 and joined the Mid-Atlantic Church, and he was really motivated not to be like Leicester Conference, you're not. Like, that doesn't make any sense to you at all. You probably don't even have any friends in Leicester Conference anymore. So that is not a viable vision for a church, just not to be Amish or not to be Lancaster Conference. Like, and somewhere, I believe that as a conservative Mennonite church, we need to revitalize the vision of why do we exist? What are we here for? And I'm excited about the conservative Mennonite church. I think there's lots of reasons for us to exist, but we better figure out what they are. And it's not just that we're not like them. And if we get passionate about why we are who we are and why we do the things, why we do things the way we do, I believe our young people buy into that vision. And one of the things that excites me about young people is they want to change the world. Like, they want to make a difference. And we can do that. It can be done. So I think in the church, I think it's important that, like, church is more than just, I want to go to church with people that are pretty much like me, and I want to send my children to Sunday school with children that come from families that are pretty much like me. I want my children to grow up and marry somebody that's pretty much like me so that my grandchildren are pretty much like me. Like, that is not a sustainable vision for a church. So we have to rethink, why do we exist? And our people should be able to say, I'm part of something that it has a reason for existence. So I just think that for church leadership, especially when you're in a multi-generational church where families have been there for generations, boy, that's a challenge to kind of come up with that reason, that vision. Why are we here? Why do we exist? It's not just because our grandparents, or our great-grandparents, and our great-great-grandparents came to church here and now we're here. What are we doing? Why are we here? I just think it's a great opportunity. Anyway, there you go. I got that free, right? Yeah. Anything else? All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I'm supposed to let the
moderator here take care of it.
Ending.
Thank you, Merle, very much. It was very, very good to be in here. And I heard you say be intentional and think about what you're doing. And so really appreciate it. So from now on, at 11:30 is the next breakout session. Also, lunch, one, all the time. So any questions about where to go, what to do, you can ask one of us or me afterward. But you're dismissed. Thanks.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.